You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
It's been more than 75 days since Maria, the 10th most intense hurricane to ever hit the Atlantic, caused catastrophic damage in Puerto Rico.
6 days after Hurricane Maria made landfall on the island, millions are without electricity and many still are struggling to get essentials like food, water, and fuel.
During this period, many have asked if the island is getting the same attention from the federal government as other areas in the United States hit by natural disasters. At this point, more than 30% of the island's residents are still without power. Nearly 20% don't have phone or internet, and hundreds of people remain in dozens of shelters across the island. But does Puerto Rico's struggle to recover stem from neglect or the financial crisis that came before the bad weather hit? Is it a combination of the two? This is Luisa Lemi for ASCOA Online. I spoke with Dr. Edwin Melendez, director of the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at the City University of New York.
My hopes were to go back after 2 years. My family came with me at the time. I have one son, and then my other son was born. And, you know, one thing led to the other. I finished a PhD, and then I got a good job here. And half my family is still in Puerto Rico, and the other half is in the United States. This is the story of the Puerto Rican community. So in that sense, we're reflective of that.
Melendez compared what happened after Maria with other big storms in the United States and explained how Puerto Rico's status in relation to the federal government might affect recovery. Thank you so much for giving this interview to me today.
My pleasure to be here with you. I appreciate the interest in Puerto Rico, and let's see what we can do.
Dr. Melendez, can you explain a little bit first your title and your work here at Hunter College? So what do you do, what the center does?
Yes, I'm the director of the Center for Puerto Rican Studies. This center was founded over 40 years ago by a group of rebellious students and faculty. And it was intended to provide a training for doctoral students that will become professors throughout the CUNY to infuse a little bit more of intellectual energy from our community to the university and from the university to our community. We also now have a strong engagement component, conferences, all type of activities about educating about Puerto Ricans in the U.S., which is our primary mission. But nowadays, for the last 2 or 3 years, as you know, Puerto Rico has been in a crisis, first economic, then fiscal, and now humanitarian. And all in all, wrapped around a political crisis. So there is plenty of interest in Puerto Rico, and we're trying to live up to those expectations.
In a sense, I feel that by reading and looking at what happened after Hurricane Maria, a lot of reporting from the media was also about explaining what is the relationship between Puerto Rico and the American government, and explaining the Commonwealth and what they have and what they don't have. Would you be able to explain the status of the island today?
Well, as you know, that's a topic for many hours of conversation, but in a nutshell, Puerto Rico became a territory of the U.S., some people call it a colony, of the United States in 1898 after the Spanish-American War. At the time, Puerto Rico was an autonomous part of Spain. It was a colony moving towards autonomy. And with the American Spanish War, we became a possession of the U.S. And since then, ultimately, the power of the authority over Puerto Rico is in Congress and the President of the United States. For the evolution of government in Puerto Rico was, you know, through the various laws by 1917, when Puerto Rico was granted Puerto Ricans were granted citizenship. The whole territory was granted citizenship. Puerto Rico also received more of a House and a Senate, you know, self-governance to some extent. And by the early 1950s, the United States allowed Puerto Rico to create a constitution and to create the Commonwealth. Since 1952, that was the political arrangement prevailing. And for many years, that arrangement of the Commonwealth was portrayed to be sort of an autonomous part of the United States. But come the summer of 2016, there were two landmark cases in the Supreme Court that without any doubt established that Puerto Rico is a territory and the ultimate power resides in Congress. And that was because of the bankruptcy case, and that's what opened the door for the creation of the PROMESA bill, which is basically imposing a control board, some people call it a colonial junta, to govern the finances of Puerto Rico. You still have the elected governor and all the House and the Chamber and all the local authorities, but this control board, it's called the Financial Oversight and Management Board, actually controls approves a fiscal plan, 10-year fiscal plan, and the annual budget for the government. So, and it's supposed to be a ping-pong process where, you know, the government proposes and the control board decides whether it's good or not, and then they submit amendments, and it goes back and forth until they reach a consensus. But if they don't reach a consensus, typically the oversight board ruling will prevail. And so they have gone through that in various instances, and up to date, that's where we are.
Today, that's how PROMESA has been working. Yes. And that's also interesting because this is something that I've learned, that Puerto Rico's economy and Puerto Rico's, let's say, GDP is not counted as part of the United States.
Well, that's, you know, Puerto Rico, and for that matter, all territories are very much governed by the U.S. on ad hoc basis. If you look at the constitutions or not, or the governance arrangement or not, the laws that apply from the United States to the territory is all a patch-up work. In some cases, you take the Jones Act, some of the territories are exempted, others are included. And if you go program by program, you'll see this sort of arbitrary application of what laws rules what territory. And in the case of Puerto Rico, this spans all through its history, right? So it's a very inconsistent application of legislation and programs, whether you know, you go back to tax exemption or bankruptcy laws, the federal tax credits that were at some point granted to investors in Puerto Rico, American multinational corporations, and then eliminated or phased out, and that ended in 2005. The crisis started, the economic crisis started in 2006, not coincidentally. So when the tax credits were phased out, and we can go on and on and on about the long list of instances in which American policy and programs at some point might be beneficial and at other points might be neglectful. If you take the Jones Act, for example, it's a monopoly that is granted to a couple of companies to have maritime transportation. It increases the price of the goods and services that Puerto Ricans consume, and it's all questionable, right? Whether indeed you need to maintain that type of protectionism to really strengthen American mercantile industry. But nonetheless, Puerto Rico pays the consequences.
Maybe you're already giving examples for my next question, but $70 billion outstanding debt. How much the status of the island has to do with this financial crisis?
There are a couple of schools of thoughts about that, right? On the one hand, some people claim that if Puerto Rico had parity in programs like Medicaid, they would have had to borrow less money to, and indebt the island to cover operational expenses. On the other side of that, certainly the conservative faction in Congress and other people in Puerto Rico think that structural reforms should have been taken. Like, for example, taking the big utilities of electricity and water to bankruptcy was not an option because the Congress withdrew the capacity of municipal utilities to in Puerto Rico to actually declare bankruptcy. And so some people argue that that itself created a complexity in terms of how do we get out of that debt. You know, the electrical company owes $9 billion. So as you can see, there are two sides of the argument. I think they're both right, that there should have been a more forceful implementation of policies that were consistent with getting Puerto Rico out of the situation that it was. But I think the local political elite has a lot to do with the mismanagement of the political system, of the economy, of the social conditions that we now are paying for. The cycle of every 4 years, the elections bring a new party, and the next government is even worse than the prior one. And it's a pattern that keeps repeating itself, and that somehow we need to get out of it. So if there is any silver lining to this crisis, it might be that finally we'll see a new political class emerging, entrepreneurs, social sector. As Mexico after the earthquake, you have a rebuilding of the civic society. And I think that's what we need now, a new political class, a new realignment of political forces with more sectors independent of the two ongoing ruling parties.
Now that we're into Maria,
right,
aftermath territory. This has not happened in 100 years. So it's a very new situation. Maybe this patching of legislation will happen now towards disasters. But what happens now with PROMESA, right, after Maria?
Right. Well, if what we have observed with respect to the way the administration, meaning U.S. administration, has dealt with Puerto Rico is an indication, I think that the pattern that we've seen of neglect and inconsistent policies has actually been aggravated. If you take example one example is that take the USS Comfort, a ship that is devoted, it's a floating hospital with capacity to 1,000 beds. That ship was in Texas and then in Florida just almost immediately after the storm. It took six days for the military to order that ship to go to Puerto Rico, and it arrived 14 days later. If you take FEMA, compare the response that they had in Florida and Texas versus Puerto Rico is night and day. In Texas and Florida, they were there prior to. The brigades were fast to act. Florida, the electricity was restored in a few days. If you look at Katrina as another example, when the military took over because there was mismanagement at the local level and the federal response was not well coordinated, the fact is that they kind of turned things around. Well, in Puerto Rico, it took 2 weeks to order a general to go to Puerto Rico. And when he got there, there's still a chaotic logistic coordination, and there are like two or three centers of decision making, and it's still not clear how things are going to be fixed. If you take what's happening with the rebuilding of the electrical grid, if you take the miscounting of the debt toll, if you take the contamination, the water supply was not working for weeks. When you add all of this, it's more neglect, it's more incompetency at the local level. So I don't think we have, the storm has allowed us to move beyond that situation. As a matter of fact, I think that if anything, the storm has reinforced the situation in Puerto Rico. Now, if you ask how is that reflected in terms of the status, well, it's too early to tell because on the one hand, the news that we have access to in the States is not evident that Puerto Ricans actually have access to them. The newspaper are not circulating because the commerce is all broken down. The TVs are not working, and there is no electricity in the households, in the homes. So how can you influence the opinion making? So what people see, what they perceive is twofold. people. On the one hand, they see a lot of people that are volunteering and doing hard work, and the whole initiative of the people themselves, and there's that resiliency and that reaction. And some of the troops that are coming from the States are helpful, distributing food and whatever, but the impact of that is very uneven. They don't get to remote areas. In remote areas, there is no food or water still. The roads are broken. So you have this very sort of voice of protest from the mayor of San Juan, yet the people don't know that because there are no news. They're in a blackout, right? So what's going to happen as things start normalizing? I think right now people are enraged that at first it was in survival mood and very appreciative every time they got a cooked meal by a community organization or water supply. But as days go past and the food supply is inconsistent and the water filters don't get everywhere, and so, we need to see how this is going to play out. At the same time, there is an emerging leadership, right, that is more independent of the political parties, that is taking civic action, right? So I have great hope in that, from the church, from the community organizations, the teachers in the schools trying to, empower themselves, to take action and then bring kids back to school and so on and so forth. So I have great hope that experience will be transformational. But this, at this point, is hope. It's almost like
Puerto Rican efforts to raise awareness about the island's woes go beyond the voices of Lin-Manuel Miranda, Mark Antony, and J. Lo. Here's U.S. Representative Nidia Velasquez in Congress.
We shed blood to defend the freedoms that every American in this country enjoys. So to kick fellow citizens when they are down is shameful. You said that you're providing assistance for those who lost their homes in Puerto Rico.
Melendez believes that the diaspora's efforts can change the future of the island. What is the role of the diaspora in this crisis, but also from now on?
Well, that's a very important point. The Puerto Rican diaspora has been very active over the last few years in a new way. And we've been active in solidarity with Puerto Rico, but not necessarily in solidarity with ruling parties or ruling government or what have you. And so there is an emerging people-to-people movement, both in Puerto Rico and in the U.S. The diaspora solidarity movement was instrumental, in my opinion, to get PROMESA passed. Okay, we mobilized to support the allowing Puerto Rico to restructure its debt. Right, the price of that was the control board. You couldn't get one without the others, and so therefore the end result is not exactly what we wanted or what we advocate for. But the fact is that the turning point for Puerto Rico at that point, for them to pay attention, was this effort from the diaspora. Not to say that the effort from local leaders in Puerto Rico was unimportant or inconsequential, but I think that the big difference in the new reality with respect to Puerto Rico-U.S. relations is that you now have over 5.5 million Puerto Ricans in stateside and less than 3.4 million in Puerto Rico. And if our projections from the recent study are true and we get another 500,000 migrating over the next 2 or 3 years, you will have over 6 million in the States and less than 3 million in Puerto Rico. And that's a big shift in the footprint of the Puerto Rican people.
Because they come here, they will register as residents right here, and then they're ready to vote.
They're ready to vote. I think the voting for the president or electing Congress people, as long as that notion that Puerto Rico was autonomous, right, that the Commonwealth actually represented some kind of a country that was affiliated with with the U.S., and people didn't realize how subsumed or dependent on Congress for decisions that were made about Puerto Rico. But now that's the reality. So now the value of having us with voting power and advocating for Puerto Rico is very important. Having said that, I think there is a maturity in the solidarity movement of Puerto Rico that we didn't have before. While relations with Puerto Rico leaders were always sort of one way, where they expected the diaspora to be submissive and follow their leadership, nowadays, I think there is a better understanding that the diaspora, we can think of our own, we have our own priorities, we support the people of Puerto Rico, we don't support any particular party. And therefore, the agenda that we support need not be necessarily the agenda of the ruling party at the time. If we coincide, we will support. If we don't coincide, we will criticize, or we will find ways in which we come to an understanding with the political leadership.
So we're talking about something that can be something different. The world has just seen the people of Catalonia being very emphatic on wanting to be independent. It's a tough question, Dr. Melendez, but what do you think Puerto Ricans want?
Well, that's been the $64,000 question since prior to 1898, Puerto Ricans were divided with respect to relations with the United States. Some people saw the United States as a promise of democracy, that they will get out of the colonialism of the Spanish government, and they will finally, with the support of the United States, be free. Some other people at the same time, even prior to the Spanish-American War, were advocating for becoming part of the United States. So this is a debate that has its roots way back in the psyche of Puerto Ricans. For a while, I thought Puerto Ricans were the smartest people in terms of political relations with the U.S. because we got all the benefits from being part of the United States, meaning, you know, access to the American passport, you know, relations with the military, which is an interesting relationship, you know, a monetary system, and the opportunity to borrow money in capital market through, you know, triple tax exemption and so forth. So there were a lot of benefits to that relation. And I thought, well, you know, here we are, part of, but not part of the United States. So I thought that the people that advocated for that relationship, the Commonwealth, they were really smart. They wanted to preserve their own identity as Puerto Ricans, yet they wanted to have the benefits of a larger system, right? That when Puerto Rico is in need, they could come and assist. But the logic of that arrangement has been eroded. Exhibit number one of a political crisis is PROMESA itself. So instead of moving towards a better understanding, we're moving to a paternalistic arrangement. You know, by all definitions, a colonial junta ultimately have the decision power. Having said that, there are a lot of people that claim that that was unavoidable because of the incompetence of the local government to make decisions, and that drove the country to a recession, to bankruptcy, and you know, and again, many of them claim, many of the people responsible for this, that it was the neglectful part of the United States by not giving party in social programs or not giving them representation in Congress and what have you, but completely avoiding responsibility of the local political elites with respect to where we are.
So something like Maria happens and the response is slow.
Well, you have to understand, as long as we're part of the United States and we are American citizens, we deserve equal treatment in Puerto Rico. So there is a law that rules the, you know, disaster intervention, and FEMA is the agency in charge of implementing that, and they don't say we're going to have a law for, you know, contiguous states, and then we're going to have a different law for islands or territories, right? It's just one law, and we're American citizens. So I think we should expect, though we haven't gotten so far, equal treatment with respect to, you know, intervention, you know, reconstruction, all the things that have gone wrong should, you know, we should make statements that attribute responsibility to who's responsible. The local government was not prepared for this. Their logistic oversight has been terrible. With all kind, they decided to cremate bodies without deciding whether that was caused by the hurricane or not. So there could be up to 900 fatalities of people that were cremated in recent months in the aftermath of Maria that are not counted as casualties of the storm. And, you know, the casualties of the storm officially are 51, but it's a great discrepancy. So that was this local decision made by both the governor of Puerto Rico and FEMA, who is in charge of making those decisions as well. So to try to divorce who's more responsible when they're both responsible for the situation that we have, I think it's an exercise that is not productive. What I do hope is that these voices that are emerging in Puerto Rico every day from, you know, the private sector, the nonprofit sector, the church, the civic society in general, that start, you know, bringing up the public interest of the people of Puerto Rico as opposed to the partisan interests of the political parties or the narrow interest of the ruling class or the control board. So I hope that we can strengthen that from the diaspora, that we sort of strengthen relations with those sectors that are sort of for the public interest in Puerto Rico, for the people of Puerto Rico, and that we support them as they cope with the disaster that we have in our hands.
In this context of all that happening, there will be reconstruction of the island and of the island infrastructure. What are the opportunities here, and also for this, let's say, emerging entrepreneurial spirit in the island and this people-to-people stronger relationship with the diaspora? Are there opportunities here for Puerto Rico?
Absolutely. I think that one of the challenges that we have is to come up with mechanisms of coordination between the diaspora and Puerto Rico, and to create those mechanisms of, you know, collaboration and communication. There will be points in which we have to collaborate with the government of Puerto Rico, with the political parties and the unions in Puerto Rico, but I hope that increasingly more we actually go people to people with the civic society here, all the community organizations that we have, and all the leadership that we have in the diaspora directly with the church and the students and all the other popular sectors that have a counterpart here in the States, and that we can have this people to people movement that actually strengthen that relationship, and that we can increase accountability for the ruling class in Puerto Rico, for the fiscal oversight board, for everyone who makes decisions that not always are in the best interest of the Puerto Rican people.
That's great. Dr. Milan, is there anything else that I should have asked you that I haven't, that it's important to say when we're talking about the condition of Puerto Rico right now?
This has been a great conversation, but I will say that I want to thank you and all the other media outlets that are paying attention to Puerto Rico. As you know, the media itself was a little bit slow out of the gate at the beginning. Then it picked up, and the coverage was heartbreaking, you know, to see all those images and the flooding and the people, just the suffering and the hardship that Puerto Rico was going through. And more recently, the focus has been on scandals and, you know, typical Puerto Rican politics. I will say that we're no exception to corruption and bad governance, but the kind of stories that some of the media are putting out that keep the focus where it should be. For example, this miscount of the death in Puerto Rico, I think that's critical because, you know, someone has to be accountable for those decisions that are made that are harmful to Puerto Rico. You know, the rebuilding Puerto Rico is a long project. And so I'd like to thank all of you who actually cover the issue. Anything that I can do to support efforts to just, you know, tell people our story.
That's great. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. For more, visit as-coa.org.